When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You bewitch me every damn second you're with me. I try to think straight, but I'm falling so badly. I'm coming apart. You wrote me.
Hey, it's Steve Balton. You are here on My Turning Point, where this week, Sage Baba and I have a wonderful conversation with Icelandic singer Leve. Really fun talk about her brilliant new album, Bewitched, movies, so much more. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Cool. So how's it going today?
It's going very well. Congratulations on the video release.
Thank you so much.
Incredible.
It's been a fun one to watch.
So you're based in LA now, right?
I am, yeah.
Okay.
My family lives in Iceland and I tour a lot, so I'm here like about half of the year, but
okay.
I think it's the best place to be in between.
Wait, okay, this is loud even though it's amazing, and it's funny because Larry and I were talking about Portishead.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite bands of all time.
Quite loud, yeah.
Yeah. So if you can just like speak up really loud or...
I'll talk closer to the phone. Yeah.
But yeah, congratulations on the record. It's interesting because I'm a very big believer in how environment affects writing.
Uh-huh.
So do you feel that you've now, and it's funny because I've talked about people who come from cold weather climates and live in LA.
Yeah.
So do you now find yourself writing like Beach Boys type songs?
I think, well, you know, I started writing more like bossa nova style songs after moving to LA. I think there was a definite, you know, distinction between my writing there, which I think just being by the beach and in kind of warmer climates definitely pushed me into. But yeah, I think growing up in Iceland kind of forced me to create like a big imaginary world of music, and I think that's kind of why it sounds. That's why I always like kind of strive to make like timeless, almost like a bit cinematic music, because I guess I was looking for an escape and I found that through music. So.
Okay, so I'm gonna let her go in a second because she's a huge fan, but I have to ask you as a movie buff.
Yes.
I was actually just talking about this at dinner the other night. If you could write music then for one movie, what would be the one movie that you wish you had written music for?
Like past movie.
Yes, since you say you're very cinematic.
Goodness.
Which is honestly just another way of asking favorite movies, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think if I could have written one of like the golden age films, like the old like American in Paris, like Singing in the Rain, like one of those old films, along with the score to that, I think that would have been a dream, and continues to be.
Okay.
Like La La Land.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Interesting. I would have thought it would have been something a little darker growing up in Iceland.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, it's that too. There's so many different things I want to do, but I think, yeah.
I'm always fascinated about an artist's sound and the truth in their voice, and to me, I'm just blown away by how clear and crystalline your voice is, just in its, like, truth. like in every song. So within all of the different spaces you've lived and all the different sounds you've experimented with, do you feel like you've arrived in what you know is your sound? Or do you feel like it's just an ever-going process of discovery?
Yeah, I think it is an ever-evolving process. If you even listen to the music I put out 2 years ago, it's already grown quite a bit. But I think, you know, every time I get to an album, like, I believe that's my sound. And I think, you know, with that confidence, it's like I can go through an album cycle. I think I've found my sound now in that I'm a lot more confident in using, you know, these jazz and classical references that I grew up listening to and really wanted to implement into my music. I think when I started out, I was a little bit nervous that if it sounded too old or too foreign, that it wouldn't relate to, you know, younger audiences, to pop listeners. And now that I've done this for 2 years, I've kind of and seen what my music has done. It seems that, you know, this younger generation has become, or they're welcome it more than I thought they would. So, for example, for this next album that I'm releasing, I felt a lot more confident kind of going into those roots. So I do feel like I've arrived kind of at my true style, but it may change next year. We'll see.
I have such respect for you as a musician and an arranger. I feel like the sound of an artist is not really often talked about, the arrangements, and that's such a huge part about your music. I'd love to hear about your process and the arrangements of this album.
Yeah, I mean, I care so much about the arrangements, and I'm incredibly involved in the, well, I'm a co-producer on all the songs, and so I'll usually write a song and I'll finish it and I'll bring it to my producer, Spencer Stewart, who I worked with on this album and the last one as well. And he will, I'll like show him the song, we'll lay down, you know, guitar or piano or whatever, bass and vocal, and then we'll just from there build it up just in his home studio. And that usually involves adding cello. We'll just layer cello on top of cello on top of cello, and kind of create like a, what we've been referring to as the leve string sound, which is just lots of layered cellos, and sometimes my sister will chime in on violin. And we'll lay down piano, he'll do drums and bass, and we kind of like build it up from there. But it's very, you know, we don't plan it until we're like in the room and we just like almost hear something, and then we add it. It's kind of trial and error. Sometimes we add something and we're like, oh, I don't know if that works, let me just take it away. But it's, yeah, I kind of see that as that's the full song, you know, with everything in it. It's, yeah, the arranging part is really important to me, and I think growing up as a musician first and then becoming a singer is like extra important to me.
Do you find that a lot of your initial gut reactions about your arrangements is what you end up going back to, or sometimes it's about digging to find it?
Sometimes a little bit of digging, but I will find like when I'm writing a song, just me and guitar, like I pretty much know in the back of my head what I want the production, the arrangement to sound like. I'll know if I want strings on it or if I want more, you know, drums on it or no drums. Like it's always pretty clear from the beginning.
I'm such a huge lover of jazz and R&B and pop as well, and I like to produce in both spaces.
Yeah.
As far as discerning like which to do for each song,
yeah.
How much, like, what's your process in deciding how much pop to let into this song, how much just classic sound?
Yeah. I definitely struggled a lot with it in the beginning because I was, some of my songs are more pop, others are straightforward jazz, and I was thinking so much about how to keep it consistent and cohesive, and then I realized that the common denominator is just me. Like every song I've written is my voice, it's my, you know, my speech, and my so I don't think too much about it anymore. There are some songs that quite obviously go in more of a pop direction, and that kind of is just like a natural occurrence. Sometimes I'll make choices where I'm like, I want this to sound super classical, so we're going to use these really classical kind of chordal structures, or, you know, same if I want it to be really jazzy, we'll know to like bring the drums into like a swing and whatnot. But yeah, if that answers your question.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's a natural flow.
So it's interesting for you, was there one song that really jump-started this record? Because usually there's one song that'll kind of, you know, dictate the sound.
Right. There's... Sorry?
Was there one song that dictated the sound of this record, this new one?
I think for me, the song that dictated the sound of the record was the song Bewitched, which is the title track. You know, it's like a guitar voice waltz, but then we added like a symphony orchestra into it. So I think that kind of sets the tone of the whole album, although of course some of the songs are like a little bit more almost pop rock driven or super jazzy, but they all kind of have, you know, either very thick BGBs or strings that kind of, I think, bring it all to the same world. And I think Bewitched, the song, is kind of like the central core of the album.
So what does being Bewitched mean to you? Not the song, because I never ask someone what a song means, because I want it to be open to interpretation.
Yeah.
But I love that word, and no one uses it anymore.
I know. Well, Bewitched to me is just the state of, like, being in love, but not in the way that it's so straightforward, more like you're under some sort of spell where you almost can't make sense of what exactly is happening. And I knew I wanted the album, not to go back to the music, but I knew I wanted the album.
Yeah, it's fine, yeah.
I wanted the album to be a love album, but I don't know if I've ever felt, you know, deeply in love or deeply heartbroken. It's kind of everything in between, and I think, you know, the state of being bewitched is such a great way of describing it.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because one of my favorite interviews of all time, he's actually on AWOL, is Nick Cave.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's a fucking god. And yeah. But he said the most interesting thing of all time to me, and this is the thing I quote most in interviews ever, he said that as a writer, you always write what it is you're longing for, and that's why writers have self-fulfilling prophecies. So he was telling me that if you're happy, you write sad songs, and if you're sad, you write happy songs. And he was telling me how he wrote Into My Arms on heroin in a church. And so, but again, that's interesting. So for you, who feel like you've never been deeply in love or deeply heartbroken, then to write this album, do you now anticipate that coming soon? Because, you know, again, it's funny, like, as an artist,
yeah,
I do think, Sinead O'Connor, who is also a genius, she's like, words have such power. She's like, hey, learn as an artist what to say, because yeah. You conjure.
You can speak something into existence or sing something into existence, I think. You know, a lot of my songs, especially on my past record, were, you know, about this idea, this very hopeless romantic idea of, like, falling in love with a stranger on a train, like, you know, seeing somebody, yearning for this love that you've never had, feeling like you're falling behind. And I feel like after I wrote that album, I definitely experienced a lot more with love, and this album is a little bit less of a hopeless romantic one, and it's a little bit more... So I definitely did speak some of it into existence.
Well, that's so interesting, though, because looking at it from a logical standpoint, I wonder if that's because, as well, when you write about something, you learn about it. So you know, by writing about it, you're sort of understanding more of it.
Absolutely. But songwriting for me is just detangling my thoughts. It's the same thing as journaling. It always comes... My songs are all, you know, my own stories. They're all... My songwriting is just journaling out my life via song. So, yeah, it's detangling my thoughts. So it's definitely...
Okay, quick question, and then it's your story again. But so for you, since you mentioned the hopeless romantic and love on a train... Oh, my God, that dog is so cute. So I'm a big dog person, so I get distracted. Do you ever see the movie Before Sunrise?
Of course.
Okay.
I've definitely heard that my music is very Before Sunrise-like.
Really? Okay, I wasn't thinking. It's just a fucking great movie.
Yeah.
You would hate it because it's White Kids in Love, but yeah.
It's a wonderful movie. It's definitely...
The whole trilogy is brilliant, yeah.
The whole trilogy, it's very beautiful. The music is... The whole setting and everything is very beautiful. It's definitely... It harks on this idea of, you know, falling in love with a stranger on a train.
Yeah. It's literally the quintessential movie about that, so yeah.
Exactly. It's kind of, you know, this... You always hope that will happen to you.
Yeah. I'd love to ask you about this channeling question, this conduit question. It's so fascinating to ask artists about, like, the writing process. We talked to Eloise a couple months ago, and she said she blacked out during Left Side, and it was just there.
Really?
Was there a song that you wrote, or that experience where you're just like, it's written before you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of... I think my favorite songs and the ones that are the most popular of mine, actually, are the ones that I wrote just in a second, like in like 20 or 30 minutes, and just because I had something on my mind and it just like had to come out, and like I look back and I just think, how did I even do that? I think From the Start is an example of that. I just barely remember writing it. I remember having this silly idea of kind of a, you know, this upbeat bossa nova song about being in love with your best friend. And then, yeah, just I've been trying to give like a good story for it, but it just kind of happened, you know. A couple of songs are like that.
I want to picture where you were and what you were doing when you wrote that.
I was sitting on my couch just like with a guitar, and I was kind of in this state of practicing songwriting, not only when I felt like writing, but as a craft, you know. I think when I first started writing about 3 or 4 years ago, it was such a, you know, when inspiration struck, I would sit down and I would write. And then when it came to doing this album, this was the first time I kind of forced myself to write from scratch, you know. It's like, and even if I sat down, so I sat down every day on my couch with my instrument, and I would force myself to write something. And even if it was the worst song I'd ever written in my life, I still felt like that is making progress towards something, that there might be something you take away from that that seeps into the next day, and then you write your biggest hit. So I think for me, it was, to answer your question in a really, really long way, it was just sitting on my couch in my living room, kind of in my routine of writing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I interviewed Brandi Clark, whose new album is incredible. Just writing on that, script, she was saying it's practice. I mean, basically, it's like anything.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
You have to actually practice, work on it, and from that is where
exactly.
Like those moments of inspiration just come from.
I think my biggest misconception about songwriting when I started was that it was something that just came to you. There are definitely songs that just come to you. You know, you wake up with a melody. Those legendary stories. But there's so much beauty and discipline in being able to, you know, discipline yourself to write a song on demand. And you really do get better with every song you write and every day that you put into it. It really is something that can be trained in that way.
It's interesting though, because there are days, like for me as a journalist and also creative writer and author,
right.
There are days when you look at it and you're like, I just want to fucking break my computer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh
so
my
how
God.
Do you, so on those days, are you able to push through it, or are you just like, you know?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the longer I do it, the more I can push through it, because, you know, if you've written two songs that are great ever, and then you get to your third song and it sucks, you don't have enough context to convince yourself that you're fine and you're going to get over the writer's block, right? I've been through enough writer's block and then inspiration to kind of gaslight myself into thinking that I will be fine in a month or two. But I remember the first time I had like severe like writer's block, I was like, no, my career is over. And then somehow I pushed through.
Is there one song for you though? It's interesting because, look, as an artist, you're never satisfied. You can't be satisfied as an artist, because if you are, then what's the point of going forward?
Yeah.
You always, yeah. But what does happen is you find yourself getting closer to where it is you want to be. And I look at those as sort of building blocks. So is there one song for you on this record that you feel is sort of the building block for where you want to go forward? When you look at it and you're like, that's getting closest to where I want to be as an artist.
Honestly, like most of the songs on the album I care deeply about and feel like are, you know, obviously leading me into my next steps as an artist. I don't know, every song kind of represents a different part of me and a different world that I want to continue growing into, you know. I think Lovesick for me was a step in a different direction. Of course, it still has like lots of strings and vocals on it and kind of classical harmonies, but it's a little bit more like pop driven, even like a little bit rock driven. And I think I'm really proud of myself that I pushed myself to do something a little bit different and can feel confident about it. So.
All right, if you could have one rock band in the world backing you on Lovesick, then who would it be?
Oh my God. I don't know. Oh, Radiohead. Oh, hell yeah. Radiohead.
That would be an incredible combination of Lofty and Radiohead.
Yeah, I love Radiohead. I was definitely very inspired by them in the recent months. I just think they managed to mix this very interesting kind of classical harmony into rock very interestingly on such a high commercial level. It's fascinating to me.
I love that. Was this the album that you envisioned, or did this go and become a different kind of tree that you didn't even know?
It was all my only hope for it was that I would be happy with it, and also that it felt like something a little bit different, something a little bit more mature, and I think it definitely was that, so I'm quite satisfied. I think I also just wanted to challenge myself to write an album. You know, the second album is kind of, you know, you kind of hope that you can even get through it, and the first one, especially when the first one feels like a happy accident, right? And now that I've pushed through and written an album like that, I feel that I'm proud of. I feel just very confident. I feel like I can make a third album. I'm panicking less than for the second album.
Yeah, that's every artist. You're always looking ahead to the next one.
Oh yeah, I was telling my manager, I was like, yeah, so for the third album, he was like, I'm gonna stop you right there. You need to be in Bewitched mode. I was like, okay, fair. But that's how you stay inspired, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny though, because you say you weren't sure you could make a second album. Why is that? And I mean, is it just because simply, like, it's so cliche, but it's true. You have your whole life to make a first album, and then a first album does well. And everybody's like, so wait, the second album's going to be out tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Well, I think I've been a musician my whole life, and I've, you know, had really rigorous conservatory training. So I didn't start writing until I was like 20. I'm 24 now. Not until I got to Berkeley. And so every song I'd ever written, those songs are on my first album. That was just a collection of all the songs I'd written so far. So, and every song at that point still felt like a happy accident. I was like, I would write a song after being inspired, and then I'd finish it and be like, well, thank God, hopefully I can write another one, right? So to go into the second album, I just didn't even know if I could, you know, squeeze songs out of me like that, you know. But now I do. So.
Alright, so you can write one song. What's the one song you wish you had written? Why?
Everything Happens to Me. It's a jazz standard. Let me double check who it's by.
Okay.
But there's a great, there are a couple of great renditions. My favorite one is the Chet Baker one. Composer. I just think it's lyrically and musically one of the most beautiful songs to ever exist.
So who actually wrote it? Was it
Tom Adair and Matt Dennis?
Okay.
First recorded by Tommy Dorsey, but I think the Chet Baker one is my favorite one. It's just this list of things that it's the lyrics are listing up the different situations that go wrong in your life, and then it ends with, and then I fell in love with you, everything happens to me. And I just think it's so clever.
And that was the thing that went most wrong?
Sorry?
I said that was the thing that went most wrong?
Most wrong. Okay. That you fell in love with them, yeah, and it's just tearing you apart. And I just think that's such clever songwriting. It's simple, but it's like very visual, and the music is so beautiful. And yeah, that's, I wish I wrote that song.
All right. For next interview, by the way.
Yes.
As you're sitting here talking about Tommy Dorsey and all this, and everything. Okay. We're turning this into a trivia drinking game because she is the only person I know who can match you guys in the terms of, like, it's funny, she does Misty every fucking day.
Really?
Like,
yeah.
You did that song.
It's so funny that we'll, like, listen to the two of you geek out on, like, you know, this, like, stuff from, like, you know, 1940s and what, you know. Yeah. I just want to see it. Yeah.
Times are changing.
No, it's great. The great jazz trivia game.
I'm so down. So down.
Is there a song of yours that you feel is your most beloved child, or you can't pick?
Yeah. Oh, it's hard. There's a song on my first album called Fragile that is probably one of my favorite songs I've written. And then on this album, on Bewitched, there's a letter to my 13-year-old self, which is kind of, I think, my baby. That one makes me cry every time. That was the one I wrote where I was like, I don't care if nobody listens to it, this is for me. So.
Wait, and how has the response been?
It's not out yet.
I know, but for the people who've heard it.
For the people who've heard it, it's been tears. I think it's an important song.
The reason I ask, it's so funny. Every time I have a conversation with an artist and they're like, well, you know, this is a song I just did for me. I didn't know if anybody was going to like it. And the response is like, oh my God, people lose their shit for this song.
Yeah.
Brandi Clark and I discussed that. I mean, down through history, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the response hopefully will be good. But all I want to do really is to reach other kids that are maybe 13 and thinking maybe that I get to live this dream magical life and just let them know that I felt like that at 13 as well.
Yeah, I deeply appreciate just in all aspects what you do and what you stand for as a musician. It's so needed. And I love the video this morning. What was the vision for that?
That was, well, my twin sister is my creative director, and this video is kind of her brainchild. Which is so great because we kind of share a brain, but she's, you know, a lot smarter than me and more creative visually. But yeah, we just kind of wanted to create this mid-century, like, Mondrian-like kind of dream world. I kind of wanted to be like a teenager in my, like, room in, like, the 60s or something, like a bratty teenager who, like, can't stop thinking about this boy and just dance around. Just kind of kitschy, silly energy, but it was fun. I wanted it to be kind of a look into my brain. Those are the very, like, primary, distinct colors, like, was kind of what I saw for the song, like, when I was writing it. Like,
is it fun for you to get to express that side? Because again, you do these songs that are very beautiful with the strings and the yellow, but also it's important to show all sides as an artist.
Absolutely, and I really pushed through, like, with this video, from the start video, you know, we had a choreographer, Molly Long, who's a choreographer I've actually been following for a really long time. I danced as a kid, but not for a long time, and I remember I was so nervous that I was dancing for this video. I had to, like, put myself aside and say to myself, like, you are a professional. If you care about this, like, you are going to go there and dance, because that's what you, like, that's what these previous artists have done. Like, that's what Taylor Swift does. Like, you better pull yourself together and do it. And same with my last video I did for the song Bewitched. That was a story. That was like a little movie that we made in London. And I had, like, an actor that I was acting against, and it was very, like, overly romantic. It was a little rom-com, and that was also a challenge I kind of had to act. So I've had to act and dance, which I never thought I'd have to do as a singer, but I'm so happy that I've gotten to do that, and yeah.
So what's your favorite rom-com?
My favorite rom-com is You Got Mail.
Someone else just mentioned that this weekend too.
Really?
Yeah.
Must be You've Got Mail season.
I don't know. Yeah, I always actually thought Sleepless in Seattle was way better, so I didn't really love it.
Really?
I mean, yeah.
I don't know. I have such a soft spot for You've Got Mail. I think I grew up going to the Upper West Side a lot in New York, and okay. That's kind of like an ode to the Upper West Side. I think the music is just really pretty, and Nora Ephron is such a good storyteller. So.
All right, wait, so if you could act at any time, I mean, now that you've sort of tapped into this, do you see yourself wanting to act and dance? Wait, would we see you do a full musical?
Full musical, perhaps. I'd love to. I really want to write a musical. I know that much, at least. I'd love to act as well. I think I'm becoming more confident on the other sides of my artistry. I've been a musician for so long, it was kind of so focused on being a musician that I didn't think of anything else, and now that I'm getting to this place where I'm challenging myself in other sides of my artistry, it's definitely not something I disregard.
Well, it's funny though, and then I'll make this my last question and then you can wrap it up, but it's interesting because I mentioned Portishead earlier, and I remember talking with them about the fact they made Dummy Right, and it was this masterpiece, one of the great albums ever, and they're like, we had no idea how to play live. We had to learn, because we were a full studio band. And, you know, and then, of course, to me, they became one of the great live bands in the world, because they were forced to do so. And they went from being this band who couldn't play live at all to headlining Coachella and killing it. So, as you are tapping in all these other things, are you finding as well that it's influencing your live shows and you're having more fun playing live, and as you get more confidence?
Yeah, well, I kind of, opposite to Portishead, have always been a live performer. Since I was 4 years old, I've been weekly playing recitals and going on stage. And I've kind of, performing on stage has never fazed me. I had to learn to become a studio musician, learn to record all these terms and whatnot, and it kind of, I felt like a little dumb first when I started, and there were all these buttons and people were shouting things like click, and I was like, what does click even mean? So I kind of had to go the backwards route, but yeah, I think.
But it is interesting, being a front person is different than in a recital. I mean, you get to show off different sides of your performance.
It's true.
You
That's
know?
True, yeah.
I mean, I'm going to guess, like, you know, Mick Jagger could never actually do a recital.
Sorry?
I said I'm going to guess Mick Jagger could never do a recital. You know?
Well, recital is like there's so much at stake. Often you're playing entirely solo, and you have complete, like, every single eye in the audience is on you. So, yeah.
Cool. You want to finish off?
Sure. You've just created this new way of music, and I would love to hear your thoughts. I know that everybody's like Lafayette Day on this current project, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on like where you want the future of jazz and the future of you to exist in, whether that be, you know, genre and identifying such as like such a silly thing, but it's so necessary in communication.
I think jazz and the nature of jazz is it's this ever-evolving thing. You know, I always, when people ask me why have you made a standards album, why have you recorded the standards, I always say, go listen to the old masters, the songs that were actually recorded at that time and written around that time, and you'll really get like, you know, I hate to use this word, but the vibe of that, you know, when you listen to those songs, like on vinyl especially, really you get the energy of that era. What I'm trying to do is take inspiration from that time and make it into something new with old sounds, like for this generation. So I think my hope is just to continue evolving it, and I kind of want the walls of genres to go down. I personally don't align myself with one or the other genre. It's a mix of jazz and pop and classical, and it's kind of hard to compartmentalize, and I don't really see myself doing that in the near future. I think I'll always just mix in whatever is inspiring me recently.
Well, no, it's funny though, because that's what I love about her sound, is it's like in multiple worlds. But Larry was saying today, when he was talking about what it is he works with, or what he looks for in people he works with, that it has to be in between genres, that it has to fall in the cracks.
Yeah.
So is there one artist for you, when you look at, and I lied, but this will be my last question, but when you look at their evolution over the years,
yeah,
the way that they were able to consistently grow into an artist that you admire, it's not necessarily that you're the biggest fan of, but you admire for the way they were able to grow into their sound and change and consistently change and grow?
I mean, I think this is the most obvious example, but I think Taylor Swift is just a fascinating example of somebody who's managed to stay so relevant, completely change up her sound, retain old listeners, and gain new listeners, and then move on to the next, and do the same 10 times. It's wild. It's really a study in marketing and musicality. I think the common denominator for her is her songwriting and her demeanor just as a person. I went to the Eras tour like 2 weeks ago, so this is like fresh. Really?
Yeah.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's like,
yeah, it was a lot of
such a long show. It's
I couldn't fucking stay for the whole thing. I couldn't. I'm not doing 3.5 hours of Taylor Swift. I was dying, but 2 hours and 10, I was good. And yeah, I agree with you. It was fascinating. It was also fascinating to watch the audience and to see. And what I really loved, and this is, it's funny because people keep asking me, what were you doing there? Like, this is, what the fuck were you doing at Taylor Swift? And it's for me.
Show.
I mean, what was so interesting about it was to watch people be so excited by an actual musician. And what I mean by that is an artist who can actually write their songs, play piano, play guitar, and say, to me, that was really inspiring.
Absolutely, and I think there's a reason she's like the biggest artist in the world. It's because she actually, at the end of the day, having those traits and those talents does prevail. It does make you stick out, and yeah, I think.
But she also, I've interviewed her several times, and I mean, she always wanted to be famous. It was always going to happen.
I mean,
you know,
the level.
And I don't
that
say that.
Is...
I don't say that in a bad way.
No,
but there are some people, like, to get to that level, you just have to be willing to sell your soul, like Robert Johnson.
Oh, of course. I mean, she could have stopped 8 years ago and would have been completely fine. Like, she obviously has her eye on, you know, on a god level type of prize, and that's how you get to where she is. You know.
But it's funny. Okay, so settle a debate for us then, because you guys have very similar styles and very similar loves of music. But it's funny for me, I think that getting to watch someone at that level is still very inspiring, even because she hates big shows. But like, I think like a Beyonce or something, it's like, it's still just, it's worth watching, because it's like, when you see someone who puts that level of craft in.
I thought it was really inspiring to see.
I think it's super inspiring.
And I mean, maybe it's because I come from a country of 350,000 people. Seeing 60,000 people in a stadium show up for one artist, and then in my head, I'm like, wait, she's doing this, what, 5-6 times? That's the
entire
the population of Iceland right there that's seeing her that night. So it's just beyond me that so many people are into, and they're screaming along to every single lyric. It's just, I don't know, I almost can't wrap my head around it, and it's just, it's kind of witnessing history. I know that sounds like a big claim, but it really is.
No, that's why I went. You
know. I'm unapologetically a Taylor Swift fan, so I just enjoyed it, because I've been following her since I was a kid, you know?
Best show you've ever seen?
Best show I've ever seen? Oh, I mean, probably some classical concert, honestly. That's, I think.
And by the way, every time you keep mentioning Iceland, I just keep thinking about the fact the fucking drunkest I've ever been in my life was in Iceland.
Yeah, were you there for a show?
I was there with a band called Farashi. Do you remember them?
Yeah. Wait, are they they're not Icelandic.
They are Icelandic.
They're Icelandic, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sick. Yeah.
Some guy who worked at Sony basically was leaving the label, and his fuck you to the label was like, I'm going to take 9 journalists to Iceland and party with Karashi for 2 days.
So funny.
He was leaving the label forever, and that was his like, fuck you. It was like, he worked in publicity.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious because at the time, my ex was going to school in Ireland.
Yeah.
And I was like, if I'm flying all the way from LA to Iceland, you have to fly me to London too. He's like, sure, we'll pay for it.
That's so funny.
But it was in March, and it was like 8 degrees. And so every time you walked outside, you would think that you felt totally sober.
Right.
And so then I would be like, I'm totally sober. I would go into the next bar and be like, because, you know, we're partying with these like Icelandic, so we didn't have to wait anywhere.
Right.
Because they were big at the time. And they're like, oh yeah, I would just like make you whatever you want. And then you get back to the hotel room, and the room is fit. Not one journalist drank the next day. Not one.
We know how to party. We know how to have a good time.
You know how to kill people, yeah.
Yeah.
When it's 8 degrees, you don't really feel drunk, and then all of a sudden you turn around and you're like, oh my god.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
We make sure people remember Iceland.
I remember. Well, I went to the Blue Lagoon next day, so yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. What do you want to add we didn't ask you about?
Sorry?
What do you want to add that we did not ask you about?
I think you guys covered it. Yeah, everything really I'm missing at least.
Okay.
Sick.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Steve Balton. You've been here on My Turning Point with Sage Bava and special guest Leve. Thanks.
NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.